Hello and welcome back to another edition of Humanitarian AI Today, a podcast series produced by Humanitarian AI meetup groups in Cambridge, San Francisco, Seattle, New York City, Toronto, Montreal, London, Paris, Berlin, Oslo, Geneva, Zurich, Bangalore, Tel Aviv, and Tokyo. I'm Brent Phillips. I produce the podcast Behind the Scenes, and today I'm going to guest host a special interview with Lindsay Moore from Developmetrics. Lindsay and her team recently built a sandbox for Mercy Corps, and they've been involved in helping humanitarian organizations ramp up their experimentation of large language models and generative AI. So this is going to be a special interview, and we're going to learn more about Developmetrics and about Lindsay and her views on artificial intelligence. So welcome, Lindsay. To get us started, would you like to introduce yourself and tell us more about Developmetrics?
Yeah, great. Thanks so much, Brent. Really happy to be here. And I love this podcast, and I think it's such an important subject. So really glad that you are kind of at the frontier of getting these kind of conversations started. Yeah, so gosh, it's been a long road getting to Developmetrics and building large language models for, you mentioned Mercy Corps, but other organizations like USAID is probably one of our biggest clients, and all the organizations that work with USAID. I was a foreign service economist at USAID actually for 11 years. So started in Bangladesh and was posted all over the world, the Dominican Republic. And then my last post was as senior economist at the Asia Bureau. And, you know, I think I got into large language models just because they make sense to economists naturally. You know, the fields have a fair amount in common. They both use, you know, mathematical frameworks and different optimization techniques to predict outcomes based on input data. You know, albeit with LLMs focusing more on text sequences and regressions on numerical values, but they have the same, a lot of characteristics that are the same. And at USAID, you know, I was responsible for designing projects and picking who wins projects of upwards to $100 million. And at the end of the day, I didn't feel like I had the certainty of a regression, you know, table output when making these decisions. At the very least, you know, sometimes I felt like an intervention I was picking was based on, you know, how much coffee I had that morning and the last World Bank report that I had read. And so this sense of kind of guilt was kind of overcoming me. You know, we talk about evidence-based decision-making, but the reality is that the evidence base is just too huge for humans to possibly go through it, take all the information, all that qualitative data, make it quantitative, and actually, you know, create some sort of prediction. And that's just exactly what LLMs kind of offer the ability to do, which is why it got so exciting for me. And I actually started building LLMs at USAID about, gosh, 6 or 7 years ago. I got a kind of a ragtag group of other novices who were interested in machine learning together. And we tried to create actually the algorithm development evidence large learning model that we've now created at Developmetrics. We started to try to create it there, but we just couldn't get buy-in from the leadership. There's a lot of skepticism at the time. You know, before ChatGPT came out, people really thought that machine learning sounded insane. I had a lot of people expecting me to explain how it works in an hour. And you can't really explain, you know, vectorization and embeddings. You need, you know, matrix algebra to understand a lot of these concepts. And so it never took off. Actually, about everyone from that group, initial group at USAID, left and started their own things. I also left to further build out the model, but I was the only one who actually stayed working with USAID. Others kind of went and did really cool applications of LLMs to, you know, one made a cooking website. So it was really interesting to see what everyone did from there. Basically, I ended up working with United Nations University to further build out the algorithm, years of research, manually coding data, and built kind of a small research team. And you can imagine what that's like, you know, having professors talking about what does resilience mean for 2 weeks, and then another 2 weeks dedicated to which excerpts really describe resilience. So it was brutal, but in the end, it was all worth it because I had, DELM, the Development Evidence Large Language Model, which could go through hundreds of thousands of documents, you know, all academic articles, all past project reports, you analyze it and give me that, you know, probabilistic output that I was really wanting in order to make those decisions when I was at USAID. But the only problem was that I was no longer at USAID, and so I didn't have any decision-making power anymore. And so that's why I started Developmetrics, to try to help apply this kind of a newfound superpower to the work I was doing before. But, you know, the thing is, when you do a startup, and I didn't, you know, going from bureaucrat basically to an entrepreneur, I didn't, you know, quite realize that people don't respond to emails right away. You know, when I had a .usa.gov email, people got back to me right away because they thought I had money for them. But when you have a Develop Metrics email in your startup no one knows about, takes, you know, I thought my inbox might have been broken for a little while. But then actually the head of business development at Mercy Corps got back to me. He was curious. And so we had a conversation and I showed him my slides representing, you know, I had a big hurricane graphic of clip art representing the algorithm. And he was curious and he said, you know, I'll pay you half of what you're asking for and we'll do milestones, but we'll try it. And so we used all the evidence available to analyze. We're working in Jordan or Lebanon, I forget which country now, and help them design a project that they thought was kind of a reach for them by analyzing all the evidence, creating an algorithm based on their framework. And they ended up winning the proposal. It was, I think, a $100 million project because of their strong use of evidence amongst, you know, many other benefits that Mercy Corps has to offer. And then we did it again and they won their other one. And that's kind of how Develop Metrics launched, starting with Mercy Corps. And now, you know, we've built scores of LLMs for USAID, other development organizations.
It's nice to know of people who are working on LLMs and generative AI before it was cool, before that November a year ago. I was involved in a Google workshop and I got introduced to BERT maybe 2 years, a year and a half before. And I remember I was so, it just like changed my life. You know, just, you know, the enthusiasm and to hear what, you know, deep in the bowels of Google, you know, the top engineers were working on. And I think it's so important for humanitarian actors to be exposed to sort of top tier research at tech companies like Google. And I'm fortunate that, you know, I was involved in that. And I remember we were going to try to take, you know, IADI is an open data sharing framework and there's thousands of organizations that are sharing information through it. And we were going to take just descriptions and see if we could match sector codes with the descriptions using BERT. And it was just a simple project, but I remember, you know, it's challenging to get these things started when they're not cool and to build a team around yourself and to get people interested in it and ramp it up and all that. So this is something I was going to ask you later in the interview, but, you know, what's it like pulling together teams to work on these things, especially for organizations, NGOs that maybe don't have the funding like Mercy Corps does, but they want to get involved in this stuff? And what kind of early lessons can you share about these early days and how's that relevant this year when so many organizations want to prototype, you know, AI applications?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, for me to get started, everyone thought I was crazy. You know, they always used to say you and your, you know, air quotes, algorithm, machines can't learn. But you know, the private sector had been doing this already for 5 years, granted not to the degree of sophistication today, but the development industry was just not on the same page. But now everybody is, you know, that's the, like you said, once these models came out and people began to play with it, they saw the power of it. To start, you know, I couldn't afford data scientists in the US. It was just too expensive. But luckily, when I was stationed in Bangladesh, I actually met a local programmer at a coffee shop who ended up helping me kind of get started, and a team of people there that really knew what they were doing who helped me a lot. And through those connections, was able to really put together a team of people based in Bangladesh and Tangier and Sri Lanka. And so it's really that kind of international group of people who are willing to experiment and more open that really enabled me to kind of get started. And with now, I see a lot of pretty much everyone is getting started. Everyone is testing different ideas. You know, everyone knows Microsoft Copilot, which is great for generalized applications. And they're crafting usually strategies now that are kind of piecing together Microsoft with, you know, our services and maybe even another service, because different ones, you know, have different reasons to use them, right? So I think kind of the biggest early lessons learned are just experimentation and having to be open to it. I found that every team I work with is so different and they use the outputs very differently. And once you get kind of all the information you have, the LLM, you're only half the way there. You still have to figure out how is your team going to use it. Still the human component that it doesn't replace. So having technical experts figure out how do you engage with these LLMs and work with them in a new way that works with your team? That's really where a lot of the hard work is still happening. What we're seeing is that it drives a different kind of conversation. You have all the evidence. So now instead of trying to find it and collate it, instead you have it there and you have to say, no, what does it mean? And what does it mean for us? And what does it mean in this context? So it drives kind of this higher level thinking that people, I think, like to do more, but work a little bit out of practice because we're just so used to, by the time we have all the information and do the research, we don't have time to do that higher level analysis. So it's working with teams to figure out how to do that again. And so I think the flexibility and the patience and the learning to work together is where I'm seeing the teams that are the most curious having the most success.
That's so good. Coincidentally, I just returned from a Microsoft Global Nonprofit Leadership Summit, and it was focused on AI and on Copilot especially. And, you know, a lot of people in the crowd, you know, it was really great to be there and hear about Copilot, but I think we were all wondering, what is there outside of Copilot that organizations can do? And it's just nice to sort of balance, you know, you mentioned sort of generalized applications. So can you just summarize what generalized applications are with Copilot and summarize the rest of the world? Like just getting started, like for a, you know, somebody with a humanitarian organization, large or small, just give us a sense of what they could be testing and looking at.
I think that distinction is probably the most important distinction for people to understand, especially when getting started, because these generalized applications, you know, the models are made by usually people in Silicon Valley, which is, if you think about it, usually tech sector, very male dominated, you know, has a specific worldview, and they're trained on all the information on the internet. So the output that you get is reflecting that worldview and all that data, right? And so if you want to ask, you know, a question that doesn't have any domain specificity, you know, isn't related to development itself, it's fine. You know, what are our sales? How's our sales performance compared to last month? You know, very specific things like that. Copilot's the way to go because it doesn't need domain specific information. What's really scary, and it kind of feels like the Wild West of AI, you know, like when cryptocurrency started or even the internet started, it's really those days. And you're seeing a lot of people just slapping ChatGPT models onto development data and asking questions. And the scary thing about that is in development, the terms are so specific, like women's empowerment, right? You don't want these models asking, what interventions are most successful to empower women in Pakistan? You'll ask the model, you'll get a different answer every time, and it could be hallucinating, and you can't trace back any of the definitions or any of the data sources. So some people are making decisions or writing proposals using this technique, and you get a very well-written answer, but you don't know the facts, and it's very generic, whereas specialized models like ours is trained with all the definitions. You know what the definition is of the term, of the data that it's coming from, because you can limit it based on kind of your own. So technical experts actually help. Yes, these are the right definitions. These are the data sources. This is how I want the algorithm to be structured. So it's kind of baking the technical expertise of development practitioners into the model. So when you get the answer, you know where it comes from, you know the definitions, and you can tailor it to your organization. So even, for example, USAID, the model we built for BHA, the Bureau for Humanitarian Assistance, they have a different definition than REFS, the Bureau for Resilience, Environment, and Food Security. So different offices at USAID have their own models because they define resilience differently. So if they each ask the same data, that question about resilience, they'll get different answers, but they'll know why. And this is what's so important about domain specificity, and also just because the words we use in development are often much more, would be interpreted as negative by most models when it's just how we speak. We don't mean it negative, you know, poverty, we're talking about different tough terms, but we don't mean them negatively. And it will, generalize models we're finding assign a negative sentiment and misinterpret a lot of the meaning behind the words.
So it's interesting, you mentioned domain-specific models, and we're going to interview the Sphere Standard people on the podcast series. And you know, they try to advance humanitarian standards. And it's interesting, you're right, you know, different organizations have their own terminology and their own sector and subsector. And in terms of fun questions, do you think the use of large language models, even, you know, fine-tuned ones, somehow over time, we're all going to be using the same terminology and language. Do you think it's going to change humanity in 5 years, how humanitarian actors talk about development amongst each other and talk about humanitarian aid?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's less than 5 years. I think what's coming and how we're going to speak to each other is something we can't even imagine. Like, we'll listen back on this podcast next year and we'll be like, wow, we didn't even know what was about to happen. So I think my only like big prediction is that whatever I predict will be probably blown out of the water in a year. Yeah, I mean, I think what's going to happen is kind of what I'm already seeing with different NGOs and is that everyone wants their own language. Everyone wants to show their own competitive advantage in building their own language model. They're really putting a flag in the ground and saying, this is our framework. You know, this is how we define these terms and this is how we use them. Like, for example, when we help, we work with Chemonics to help them look at all their, you know, past data and actually use it for proposals, training materials, a bunch of other things. And when we brought them, you know, we started with kind of the data architecture we initially created on they wanted to look at partnerships, who have they partnered with in the past. And the model that we had created didn't have all these different gray areas of partnerships that Chemonics really prides themselves. They really know about, you know, women-led in partnerships. They wanted to see what are the indigenous partnerships. They really wanted to get that color. And so they built that framework out more. And then we populated that data with, you know, that framework with all their data. And then USAID actually ended up adopting that same terminology. So I think they really showed that their expertise, they could build their expertise into that model. And if someone, you know, used a generalized model versus what they built, that you could just see their own technical expertise in that model. And now the organization has that built in. So if anyone asks about this, you know, even in another sector, someone who doesn't have any idea about partnerships, they'll have that answer built in because that technical knowledge from that team will be transferred to everything else that they do. And so I think the future is we're all going to have our own model where we teach it to talk like us and reflect our worldview. So rather than becoming, I think, converging into ChatGPT, my hope is we all diverge. And, you know, if you and I had to schedule this podcast, my AI will contact your AI and they'll have like a great conversation that no other AI will have based on our own and then we'll have our time scheduled.
I love that. I was just thinking about Elon Musk's Neuralink and how our AIs will talk to each other. And then maybe it'll just plug into my head while I'm asleep and I'll be smarter in the morning. So getting back to the interview, I love diverging and then coming back to it. So again, as I mentioned, I returned from this conference and, you know, even before the start of the new year, we decided this year, we're going to really, really concentrate on prototyping for the benefit of humanitarian organizations who want to get started experimenting with generative AI. And I'll ask you, what are the first steps for humanitarian organizations? But I presume it's, you know, build a sandbox, contact somebody like you and develop metrics and, hey, let's sketch out a sandbox that we could build for you and kind of get you started. And this is what maybe we could work on initially just to give you a feel for what this is and, you know, the back end and use cases and things like that. But can you just walk us through what does the getting started look like, you know, maybe on a technical level and something that's useful for humanitarian CTOs?
Usually organizations contact us and we do a brown bag just to educate their entire team. You know, at USAID, we do a ethics and AI, we contribute to an ethics and AI training. And we replicate that a lot of organizations just to get everyone on board. I think that's kind of the first thing and get everyone, you know, on board around a goal. What is it that they actually are trying to achieve? Sometimes it's very large. You know, we want to look at all of our internal evidence and understand everything we've done and how we compare to others and what's our competitive advantage. And others just want to, you know, for example, the goal of REFS, of USAID's agriculture office, that they wanted to go through all the information available and figure out every intervention related to agriculture-led economic growth. So they really, you know, made it very specific and they wanted to assign a cost to each of those interventions. So that was their goal. And every organization we start, you know, with that goal setting, and then we even delve deeper into then the objective setting stages. I think you know how the process works. And so they wanted, you know, an LLM that just wasn't robust in parsing and understanding the nuances of development work, but also adept at extracting very specific information that they wanted and correlating it with cost. So we got really into what are the objectives. Sometimes we frame the objectives in terms of research questions. But in this case, kind of the ultimate objective was to create a, you know, comprehensive searchable database based on the LLM that we would tailor to, you know, be able to understand everything about past initiatives and enhance decision making moving forward. So that's usually how we start. And then we start the study development, the development phase, which is usually really intensive. That's where we begin really curating what is the data set that we're using and, you know, training the LLM on the new data set. It's usually more of a fine-tuning process based on whatever new variables or different kind of understanding is used. And this is really, it's a crucial stage just to train the LLM not only to understand development jargon, but also to recognize the context in which the, you know, interventions were mentioned, how the costs were discussed, right? So it's, a lot of people still think LLMs are control find. One of the key cool things is it's looking at the patterns of the words and the meaning behind it and the definitions. And then we usually are testing the sandbox. So once the model is trained, we move it to the sandbox environment, usually for testing. That's kind of where the magic really happens. You know, that's where you run the LLM through a series of tests. You know, we start with a small subset of documents, then we slowly scale up. And this is really kind of a valuable stage because it allows us to tweak the parameters, you know, refine the understanding, improve the accuracy without, you know, any risk to any live operational data that we have. And then after that, it's just kind of the analysis and iteration where we start to see the patterns come out. And that's really the fun part. You know, in this project, creating the LLM for this USAID Bureau, we saw these incredible historical patterns and interventions that no one knew. We saw, for example, the rise of their use of the research and development intervention kind of correlated with the Green Revolution. And we just saw, we dug into the academic literature, and we saw that that specific intervention is highly correlated with agricultural productivity. And we really see that historically. But then we noticed, gosh, this incredible decline in the 80s. I think the use of research and development went down. And today it's like less than 5% of projects or something, I mean, are using it, at least from the subset we are looking at. And we saw that it actually correlated with the Bumpers Amendment, which is this, I guess, this USAID agriculture officer in the 80s. I actually met him. He told me the story himself. He got into a bit of trouble because he was helping Brazilian soybean producers develop new soybeans. And the U.S. soybean lobby got pretty angry and ended up creating this amendment saying, you know, you just can't invest in agricultural development of commodities that could compete with U.S. commodities. And so because of that one situation, USAID's portfolio has been, you know, really hit. And so being able to see that trend allows the team to think, okay, what can we do to, you know, contribute to research and development, but, you know, staying in the lines of the of this kind of, you know, confinements within this amendment, but still there's a lot of opportunity to do research and development. So just being aware of these trends is amazing.
That's so cool. Going back to just you know, I always feel there's so many different questions, like what you just said, all of it is so cool. Going back to the use case of a NGO, you know, a mid-sized, small-sized NGO, can you demystify for us what is a sandbox and what does that entail, you know, on a technical level? Like, what is it? Where do you set it up? And then the second question, you know, organizations, they want to do some testing and they think about, you know, they just want to securely test their data in a safe space and be reassured that none of this is going to get revealed to anyone. Can you talk us through the sandbox and then talk us through the data privacy part of just getting started, what it looks like?
That's a huge and very important question. So it really depends on type of information, if it's all public, proprietary information, kind of the different routes that you take. For NGOs, we, because it's often these teams have very limited capacity in terms of time that they really have to dedicate to this. So often we would do the whole process ourselves and don't, you know, involve them in the sandbox or the technology part unless they have a person on their team who's very interested and then they can actually be involved in the development. But that's rarely the case. Usually we test the output with them, we check the definitions, we make sure it's tailored. But apart from that, they don't often get really into the sandboxing stage. We realize, you know, I used to love to talk to people about all the technical parts. I realized that that's not, you know, it's not great to be so in love with your own solution that you don't want to talk about all the technical parts of it. It's better to just see how it applies to them. So usually we don't go really deep into that part. We just show them the output and tailor it. But we mostly use cloud-based solutions for for our sandboxing, and it's the security is huge. We're going through FedRAMP certification, so it's a very long process. USAID is our authorizing agency, and we're with them. They're actually in there. They'll be testing all of our security, trying to break everything. And so it's about a year process that we are in the progress of getting the certification from the government, which is, I think, the highest level certification, just to ensure that, you know, USAID gives us confidential documents. We're getting other confidential proprietary information. Probably half of our business is just focusing on that part, but most people don't ever see that side of it.
That's super interesting. You know, I've been reading about the Apple Vision Pro, and I think we all, like with technology, we all want to have the new shiny device, even if, like, I actually have a, you know, a Meta VR headset, and I think it's still in the box, and it's, what, a year and a half, 2 years old, but I remember I had to have it, because then I wanted, there's all the stuff I wanted to do with it, and like, the Vision Pro, wow, it sounds so great, and, you know, I like IATI, the International Aid Transparency Initiative, the data, and, you know, I just want to look at it graphed in VR. And just see what, like, see what, you know, all the organizations working around the world and how they interconnect and, you know, these sort of nodes and relationships, and see what else I might be able to see data-wise and what sort of ideas come to mind. But, you know, so I want the vision, you know, I'd love to have the Vision Pro, and somehow magically all this stuff is, I'm going to start doing that. But, you know, I can see how organizations, they want to have a sandbox in their pocket. And they, even if they just, you know, sharpen pencils with it, they just, they want to have it. You know, you'll spin up an instance of, you know, in DigitalOcean or, you know, AWS. And what do you put in it? And what does this magic sandbox look like?
Yeah, usually it's in AWS, even, but some applications, like for USAID, is offline altogether. You know, one of the things that we're doing is we're auto-generating PPR, policy planning reporting documents. So they're reporting to Congress. And in those kind of more sensitive cases, we take it offline altogether, just so that it's not, just for security and also to keep it separate. So, you know, so the inputs are usually just, well, it depends on what large language model is sometimes serving as the base. You know, so often we go back to some of these base models like Roberta, just because, like, ChatGPT, you know, doesn't have some of the adaptability, the fine tuning ability that you can apply to these base models that we actually love. So it depends, you know, on the question, on the data set of how we set up the sandbox and what exactly inputs that we put into it. But if it's not offline, then usually it's in AWS, and that's where our data science team really starts playing around and making sure that whatever the adjustments are doing aren't influencing the core model or skewing it too much, because each organization has their own tailoring of it. And so that's where we do that specific tailoring.
I feel like we're going to buy a car here next, but tell me about models. You know, it's interesting, like, a lot of people are experimenting with Llama. Like, I think that's sort of the go-to model that a lot of people are using for their research. Tell me about Anthropic and Llama and DeepMind. And, like, a lot of people are developing their own models, and we have open source models being developed. But what are your favorite, you know, makes and models?
You know, we just published, we're publishing a paper, I think, hopefully next week in World Development on kind of our benchmarking, where we benchmarked a couple models together to show the different results of creating Dellum and how you can adjust it versus different models. And so, I can share that. But, you know, I'm old school. Like I said, I love Roberta. I just do, because I find that it's very sensitive to fine tuning. So you can only, you know, fine tune about 1% of the data. It's very adaptable. And so it's a good base that you can do a lot more with than some of these more hyped up models, like, you know, even Electra or even BART. So, you know, I'm not in the end of the day, I don't myself do the training anymore. I've hired now a whole team. So I don't often get so much into the weeds anymore like I used to. So that's probably maybe why I have a love for these older models. The GPT models are impressive in a lot of ways, but I find that they have a mind of their own, and they're more difficult to adapt.
You know, it's interesting. I still want to experiment with BERT. It just seems like, again, thinking about data and training and testing and prototyping, you know, for example, with a graph database, like a Neo4j graph database, you know, you input your relationships and your nodes and your, like, all this stuff. And it seems like, you know, you can have structured data or unstructured data. And if you graph it, you know, and create all these structured relationships, it's easier for the model to output something useful. And it seems like, you know, going back to some, maybe some of these older tools, you have, you know, more control to really stick to the data and the relationships.
Exactly.
But, you know, what do you think about that? Getting off track again for a split second, what do you think of like databases and graph databases and structured data versus unstructured data? I'm sure it's a good question for NGOs.
Yeah, because pretty much everyone has unstructured data. And that's often a big concern. We pretty much only deal with unstructured data. We do all the structuring ourselves. We very rarely, or actually have never come across data that is nearly structured. We usually just get a link into somebody's SharePoint or, you know, look at all these you know, a lot of the USA documents we deal with are typewritten. So we always kind of structure the data ourselves, and the way that we communicate kind of that graph to NGOs and other humanitarian workers who don't necessarily understand a graph in the technical, we start with kind of a hierarchical, what we call a taxonomy, which shows all the labels and their relationships in two dimensions, which can get confusing to people because people intuitively know that it's really three-dimensional. You know, there's lots of relationships between the terms. It's not just like this term is related to this term, but unfortunately we don't have, you know, your 3D headsets that we can put on people so that they can go into their data and look at all the various connections in the graph. So that's kind of one of our biggest communication challenges, is actually going, you know, from the flat to the kind of 3D world with lots of nodes and edges and, you know, different properties. So that's kind of the biggest challenge. But I think also the most exciting thing about it is that it can make data into graphs.
It's so interesting how the world has shifted full circle, and that, like, thinking about structured and unstructured data, like, it's so cool. Like, we've been waiting for this day when you just, through brute force, we can go through unstructured data and pull insight out of it. You know, it's just like the internet, the promise of the internet back in the 90s.
Exactly.
And, like, you know, we can do this cool stuff. You know, we just published an interview with the Ukraine country managers from the Danish Red Cross and Norwegian Refugee Council, and we spoke about the wintertime humanitarian needs in Ukraine, mm-hmm. and then AI, and then about what can we really, really do in the field, you know, in a wartime setting, urgent, urgent humanitarian needs. You know, let's say I'm a small NGO and I want to ramp up my experimentation of AI, and I want to do something useful right now, and I feel the need to really put some urgency behind this, you know. What are your thoughts on that? That, you know, they just called you on the phone and they're like, we really don't know what to do. We want to try some things. Let's ramp up something really fast. You mm-hmm. know, what comes to mind to you right away?
Yeah, you know, we're always up for trying new things. I think it depends on the innovativeness of the team and their, you know, ability to tolerate risk. Because sometimes these things do take a lot longer. You know, certain donor organization actually just called me from a different country the other day and said, can you build our large language model in 30 days and create an interface? You know, so we can use it in kind of right away in a certain setting. And it's like, okay, we'll try, you know, 30 days with the interface and developing a whole, you know, large language model for you is going to be first iteration, but you still need to keep working. So I think just taking that risk, hey, let's get something out, let's put something together that we can start with and then go from there. So, you know, what is your wildest goal? And then how do we then scale back expectations? Where can we have a solid starting point that will convince everyone of its value that you can then kind of go from there? So we try to get those quick wins right away so that everyone's on board and then build it out with organizations. A lot of it is just working directly with people on that. But I think, you know, the other side of your question in terms of rapid deployment is just the balance and the importance of it. Because imagine, like you said, it's like getting a superpower now that we can go through all this unstructured data and like get these kind of probabilistic answers we've all been looking for to, you know, interpret and then apply our technical expertise. It's incredible. And it needs to happen as soon as possible in these really dangerous situations. You know, we do it with, for example, an NGO who is working on food security and that developing early warning systems. And they want to quickly have an LLM go through all data so that they can better fine tune, you know, the questions like how do people in this urban area of this country working, how do they access food? They don't know. Throw the LLM, go through it all so that we can then quickly adjust our strategy to help them. So things like that. But then again, there's always that trade-off with the ethical use of AI. And, you know, it can, like I said, AI can be transformative, but there's also that potential downside where if people are just using it as the answer, oh, here's the output, this is the answer, it can get dangerous. So also that training of people, okay, this is, you know, the consensus of the data sources that we looked at, but like any research, it's only as powerful as the data sources themselves, and you still need that human technical expertise to interpret those answers and say, okay, but it's probably missing this aspect, or in this country context, it's missing this. So I think that piece is it's like, you know, people get worried that AI is going to replace their jobs, but I think in humanitarian development, it actually just makes people's jobs more interesting and even more relevant, because the AI can't give the answer. There's still so many components that need to go in. And I think emphasizing that piece, because often in these rush situations, people just take the answer and go because they're just so, everything's so urgent. But we still need to pause and apply kind of the normal rigorous thinking that people usually would apply without LLMs.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, again, they feel pressure to be working on large language models right now. And it seems from what you just said that, you know, testing is one thing, but then it goes back to a human again to evaluate how can we safely, ethically, responsibly experiment with this information. And it seems like any organization is too small to really be able to do this effectively. And I think this is the year we really, it just emphasizes the importance of collaboration between humanitarian organizations and around AI. And I think a lot of organizations kind of work in silos and they need to break out of that silo mentality. And I think we all intuitively know that we need to be tightening up our collaboration across organizations. And I know this is something that IRC's Signpost Initiative is going to be helping to lead and encourage as more collaboration around AI. So can you speak to this? Like, it's true, isn't it? We've really got to learn from each other and collaborate on this sort of decision-making process of experimentation.
Yeah, for sure. And that's why I so appreciate your work in terms of getting people together to discuss and kind of uniting the various different silos of things that are happening. I mean, also the cool thing about AI is the ability for it to break these silos. You know, we see that about, you know, when we do LLM for organization working in conflict, while at the same time we're building a one for another organization working in health. And then we saw that about 70% of the variables that they were interested in the data overlap. And then you can see that you can quickly take lessons from, you know, training that was applicable in both situations and cross-fertilize the field in that way. And then those silos are no longer relevant when you're working with graph databases, and same with the regional silos. You know, all of a sudden a lesson that's relevant from Kenya is more easily transferred to Uganda, whereas before people were stuck within those geographical silos. So I hope as an industry we learn from, you know, that nature of LLMs to apply it together where we can learn from each other's current efforts rather than recreating the wheel, which is a huge tendency in this space. But so far, the signs are optimistic. You know, I've had a lot of organizations come to us and say, well, you've already built this. You know, for example, Dahlberg said, oh, well, we were going to build it, but you did it. So now let's iterate together. What can we do together? How can we partner? And I've seen that approach with a lot of different organizations. And so I think I see that collaborative nature is kind of natural in the technology industry. So I'm hoping that will help kind of overcome a lot of those challenges and really get to that goal that you're working on.
Thank you so much for that. I think it's so important for humanitarian organizations to really accept that we need to work more closely together. And thank you so much for sharing that. And that's another reason I really wanted to have you on the podcast series. So back to large language models. When I was getting started, I didn't quite understand what they were or what that would entail me doing, try one out. And then I realized, you know, we got access, our humanitarian AI meetup community got access to LLAMA, the model, and Facebook Meta, they sent us the weights. And then I realized that the weights are what are important that we needed to upload and all that. But can you just share in a nutshell what they are and what, from a technical standpoint for a humanitarian actor, what does acquiring a large language model entail and what is it? And just kind of demystify it for us.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a little bit hard. Like you said, it's super complicated and there's different models use weights differently. But often, you know, I think of it as, and I don't know if this is too technical, but, you know, it's thinking of it in terms of tokens. So a lot of the ways that we use weights are to learn representations of words in the vocabulary. So each token is associated, you know, with this vector representation within the model's embedding space. And these representations are learned during the training process based on the context which the tokens appear and based on this reinforcement learning adjusted to make sure that the understanding of the word and the way that we want it is used. And this is really particularly, I think, useful with fine-tuning models so that they can be, you know, fine-tuned on specific tasks or domains to change an existing model like the llama model or that you're talking about to update those pre-trained weights that you're talking about of the model using task-specific data to improve performance. So that's where the very unsexy task of manually coding and providing that feedback loop so that you can improve the performance on the downstream tasks like text classification or name entity recognition, et cetera, if that makes sense.
That's good. And I remember it held us up because we had to download the weights and it, you know, we needed like gigabytes and gigabytes of storage space within a week before the weights, the access link timed out. But on a technical level, what's entailed in terms of just getting started? Like obviously you download, you know, if you're able to download them, you need to put them in a bucket and then you develop some code to interact with them. But on that very sort of narrow technical level, what's all that about?
So it depends again on like the data, the question, exactly which model we're using and how we're training it. I think maybe one, and I'm actually not the data scientist who does it all, but what I do, like one of the things that I find particularly interesting that our team does is, you know, like I said, the basis of everything we do is our training data that's been reviewed. So that's where we always kind of start from. And then we use LoRAs. I don't know if you know about low rank, goodness, I forget what they stand for, adaptation. I forget what they stand for. But anyway, they help. They're really valuable in terms of adjusting and fine tuning models. So you don't have to download the whole model or work with these ginormous data sets, but instead you could fine tune, for example, just 1% of a model in order to adjust it to the domain specificity, but you still need an incredible amount of manual training data. You know, we have been working on it for over 5 years, and even then we still have to, we have a team of 20 researchers constantly creating new manual data to help us improve the weights, to constantly improve the accuracy.
You know, speaking of all your engineers and your needs, and, you know, this is 2024, and this is the year of kind of prototyping, and you know, there's a lot of grant funding initiatives that are supporting experimentation around large language models, around generative AI. And as a key startup critical to the humanitarian community, give us your pitch on what you need this year and what would really help you to scale your ability to help nonprofits and NGOs, humanitarian organizations.
That's a great question that no one's ever asked me. So yeah, thanks. You know, there is a lot of talk out there about boarding female entrepreneurs, especially in the tech space and especially in the AI and humanitarian space, but I haven't accessed any financing related to that or been able to find any kind of opportunities out there. There is a lot of grant funding for on the ground applications, you know, things that really pull at the heartstrings. Like we were able to provide this medical advice and we say, those kind of very important on the ground applications, I think, are receiving a good amount of funding. What's less being funded is the systematic level approaches where we're really thinking about the ethical implications of applying the technology in the first place and really applying kind of the first principles. Even though there is a lot of talk and strategies coming out around the ethical use of AI, we're not seeing a lot of investment in creating those frameworks. And so one of the things that we're really trying as our big mission right now is, you know, the models that we're building for NGOs, for USAID are all based on the Western perspective, right? They're the models are based on the global North's perspective of what things mean. So right now we have a proposal into the Rockefeller Foundation and are looking for others to help us build a model that actually brings in the local perspective. So instead of using, for example, USAID's perspective of what does women's empowerment mean and what is a successful women's empowerment intervention, we're hoping to pilot in Thailand one where we actually look at local communities and ask them to interpret the data and build the models for them so that we can show that even the same models looking at the same data, fine-tuned, you know, using these weights that we discussed, based on the perspective of different people, changes the results. And that's crucial because if people don't start understanding these models are going to be driving decision-making that are going to be reinforcing existing biases rather than addressing them and really contributing to meaningful change.
You know, coincidentally, I'm going to speak at a tech talk, a humanitarian tech salon at the Rockefeller Foundation. And it's cool to hear that you're, you know, hoping to work with them. And it's interesting, you know, back to grant funding foundations, it's a shame that you have to work, you know, NGOs want to try these things, so they need to, you know, get a grant to do it. And then they need to contact you as a tech startup to help them. But actually, you have a better handle on what kind of foundational research we need to be, as a community, we need to be doing right now. And it's critical. And I think on this podcast, it's so important to get across what we need to be doing and who are the stakeholders who could be doing this research. And I think, again, DevelopMetrics, you know, you're so critical to the humanitarian community. And what kind of foundational research would you like to be carrying out that you would like funding for?
Yeah. Well, I mean, adapting to the local context, comparing, benchmarking the different models. So, okay, you're using this model. How is it impacting your decision-making versus kind of a more fine-tuned model? So we really clarify the assumptions behind the models we're using to drive decision-making. That's a huge area that needs to be looked into desperately. So just benchmarking and domain specificity. And then also, you know, I could go on, but also there's the use of the models to actually make decision-making, right? So that interaction between the models and the humanitarians on the ground, like you brought up before in Ukraine, that needs to be studied more. With what is that? Where does the AI meet the human, and how do we improve those processes? And what is the role for the technical expert in this new world that's coming, whether we want it or not? How can humans most efficiently be used or best be used to complement and work with these new tools that we have? I think there's a lot of research that needs to happen kind of around that as well. And then just applying the LLMs to this, you know, we have over the USAID Development Clearinghouse has over 60 decades of project reports. And that's combined by, you know, millions of other documents that we now have access to. So the questions you can ask and the things you can explore now is unlimited. So delving into all that data and really using it and applying it, I think, would be a third stream. But I could go on forever. So maybe I'll stop on those three points.
That was good. It's interesting, as a community, our humanitarian meetup groups, we've long talked about kind of scraping the humanitarian data exchange and, you know, scraping all these repositories. Like, that needs to happen yesterday.
Exactly.
And we need to knock it out. And thank you. Thank you for validating that, because, you know, for all you grant funding platforms out there, foundations, like, if you want to really jumpstart foundational research, humanitarian AI research, we need help just pulling together all this data to work with it and to get the stakeholders together. And we talked about just humanitarian actors being more comfortable about speaking with one another, you know, privately behind the scenes, you know, the tech folks. So Lindsay, we have a closing question that we ask everyone on the show, and that's to envision a futuristic AI application that you'd love to see exist and to describe it for us. So what's anything that you would love to see, and what's something that maybe you would love to see benefiting humanitarian actors that you've thought of as you've worked with humanitarian actors?
Yeah, you know, I'm where my mind is now thinking about the future of AI is when it has agency, as if, you know, it might already, I think it probably already does. We just might not know about it. But anyway, you know, an agency meaning that it actually is making decisions on its own, you know, and carrying out those decisions. You know, so I think in terms of logistics and just, you know, like we were saying, we could probably already have the AI schedule our meeting and we would just show up and be here. So it will definitely make things more convenient and hopefully improve efficiencies. You know, for our own work, my vision is really that imagine if all development decisions were made with the most informed possible, the amount of money that it would be better used and the results that would actually occur if the incredible resources are used more efficiently. So for me, it's not even an issue of more development funding, it's just better used. And I think that LLMs can target these interventions in a way that will catalyze results in a way that we've never seen it before. So that's what I would love to see.
It's interesting. I was going to ask you next and lastly for a shout out, you know, anything you want to draw attention to or causes or, you know, upcoming events that you're going to be involved in or projects. But actually, you just gave us a shout out as well. But is there anything else you'd like to share?
So we are actually hosting an AI for Development conference in Barcelona in October. It's invite only, but interested for any speakers. We're still accepting suggestions. Of course, we'll have to have you there, Brent. And then, you know, I think one organization just to highlight is the Center for Values in Development. They are doing a lot of interesting work right now around ethics. You know, they're ethicists, they're philosophers. We're talking about agency and machines. You know, if you think about the future, where are they going to take, you know, a perspective of utilitarian benefit and let's do the things that, you know, improve the benefit for most people or more, you know, Kantian universal principles. How are these machines going to side with different philosophers and make these decisions for us? You know, if they're, for example, automating cars, and which passenger are they going to protect? These huge ethical and moral questions that we're still grappling with as a human race. How are these machines going to decide? And this Center for Values is really looking deeply into these kind of more philosophical questions. So I think shout out to them and their work for sure.
So what are you excited about this year on the generative AI front? Like, what's personally exciting to you in terms of maybe some possibilities that you'd love to kind of stitch together at Development Metrics?
Gosh, I mean, I think just expanding, honestly, on work that we're already doing and seeing the fruition of models that we've started, seeing the projects actually on the ground and the results that are coming out from these already in terms of just better ways that people are communicating and using evidence. I think that's what's really exciting. And just, you know, getting these things started is the hard part. So now that we're starting to see the results, you know, the amount of hours saved, the one USAID mission said they saved 1,200 hours because of the auto-generating of documents, staff time. So that people realizing and having those aha moments with AI and feeling like that power that you and I both mentioned we felt when we first explored these LLMs, seeing others realize that and the new ways that they're using it, I think is really exciting.
Lindsay Moore, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. And again, you know, you've been on our radar for some time, and this is the year for prototyping. And we're really fortunate to have been able to really dig into this question and draw out some insight for humanitarian organizations interested in experimenting with generative AI. So thank you so much for being on the show. And this brings this edition of Humanitarian AI Today to a close.